Let's continue with our look at the judgeship of Jephthah in Judges chapter number 11, starting at verse number 34. Jephthah was the illegitimate son of a man named Gilead, who shared the name of the region that they lived in on the east side of the Jordan Valley. And Jephthah had been run out of town and run away from his inheritance by his full-blood brothers, his half-brothers, but the full inheritance brothers. And he'd gone and become the leader of some sort of gang. He seems to have some basic morality to him, even though he does have some rough guys working for him during that period of time. So the Ammonites, who are the eastern neighbors of Gilead, they come and oppress the Gileadites for 18 years. And God allows this because of the paganism, the sinfulness that has risen within Israel again. But eventually, they repent, they get rid of their idols, they make commitments to come back and worship only He who is. And they prepare to attack the Ammonites when they invade on this particular year to take their stuff from them. And they're looking for a leader, and they decide that the best man to fight on their behalf would have to be Jephthah, the warlord. So they bring him in, and they make a deal with him. If you'll do this, you can be the head of Gilead when it's all over with. And so he agrees. And so he tries a little bit of diplomacy to convince the Ammonites to go home and stay on their side of the border. But that doesn't work. So he then collects the army of Gilead and Manasseh. Nothing is said about Reuben. Reuben is off to the south. It's possible he might have picked up some of the Reubenites for this, because they would have also been impacted by the invasion of the Ammonites. But he takes his army and he attacks the Ammonites and just wipes the floor with them, with God's help, with God's assistance. And then it's time for him to head home. Now, he made a promise to God. He made an oath to God before he left that if God would give him victory over the Ammonites and thereby let him become the leader of Gilead, that he would offer as a sacrifice to God the first thing that that belonged to him, which he saw when he went back to his residence. And so his residence, by the way, has now been moved to Mizpah. This is Mizpah of Gilead. It's on the it's southeast of the Sea of Galilee. Don't know exactly how far southeast, but it is Jacob's Mizpah from his story. And so this is where he set up his residence and where he is going to lead as judge. Verse 34, Jephthah came to his home at Mizpah, and behold, his daughter came out to meet him with tambourines and with dances. She was his only child. Besides her, he had neither son nor daughter. So this is where Jephthah discovers the very hard way that you need to be careful when making oaths to God. The wording of his oath indicated he expected he would see some sacrificial animal, like a bull or a goat or a sheep, at the very edge of his property as he was coming back. What he did not anticipate was that his young teenage daughter, unmarried daughter, his only child, would be so excited about Daddy's victories, the victory over the Ammonites, but also the fact that he is now going to become the leader of Gilead, that this young daughter would be so excited to welcome Daddy back from the victory, or for this victory, that she would go out beyond the property and be the first thing that belonged to him that he would lay eyes on as he was coming home. Verse 35, as soon as he saw her, he tore his clothes and said, "Alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low. You have become the cause of great trouble for me." Now, she doesn't know what she did yet. She's about to find out. But he is very upset that she became the object of his vow. "For I have opened my mouth to he who is, and I cannot take back my vow." Once you make a vow to he who is, you're supposed to keep it. She said to him, "My father, you have opened your mouth to he who is. Do to me according to what has gone out of your mouth, now that he who is has avenged you on your enemies, on the Ammonites." Now, this passage here has become the fodder for a lot of bad Bible teaching, I think. There are a whole lot of teachers out there that have insisted that Jephthah killed his daughter, burned her up as a sacrifice. But I am telling you, as a Bible teacher, that is not what he did. He clearly has some sort of commitment to God that is serious. And so he is keeping his vow. But you have to remember, back when we were studying the law of Moses, given by God, that the rule was you could substitute a more appropriate sacrifice for one that you had vowed, but both the substitute and the original thing that you vowed belonged to he who is. It didn't belong to you any longer. So Jephthah most certainly substituted an animal sacrifice, an appropriate animal sacrifice, which he burned up to God as part of the fulfillment of his vow. Because the Israeli law does not allow for human sacrifice. It is anathema to the law. But the Jewish law would have dictated that the daughter was no longer under Jephthah's control. She now belonged to he who is. Effectively, practically, she would have had to probably take off to Shiloh, to the tabernacle, and do whatever it was that the high priest gave her to do for the Lord. Jephthah could not betroth her to anyone because he no longer had control of her life. God had control of her life. So both Jephthah and the daughter recognize the fact that she will never get married. She will never have children, and that means that Jephthah's family will dead end with his death. That's the reality of the situation, which is why there is so much grief, so much mourning that is going on here. Verse number 37, she said to her father, "Let this thing be done for me. Leave me alone for 2 months, that I may go up and down on the mountains and weep for my virginity." See, to cry about the fact that I will never get married, never become a mom. Let me do that, I and my companions. You know, me and my girlfriends, the girls I grew up with. Let me go and cry my eyes out for 2 months. And so he said, go. Then he sent her away for 2 months. She departed, she and her companions, wept for her virginity on the mountains. At the end of 2 months, she returned to her father, who did with her according to his vow that he had made. Meaning, he gave her to he who is. Sent her off to the convent, if you will. That's a rough equivalent. Sent her off to Shiloh and offered the sacrifice that would have been the substitute for her. She had never known a man, and so it became a custom in Israel that the daughters of Israel went year by year to lament the daughter of Jephthah the Gileadite 4 days in the year. So probably in Gilead itself, the custom became an annual grief over the loss of the Jephthah line. The fact that his beloved daughter never got a chance to get married or have a baby. And so that family, which was the family that saved Gilead, dies because of the vow that Jephthah made. Another good reminder, don't make promises to God unless you plan on keeping them. Actually, Jesus and his half-brother James teaches us that we should not take oaths of such because we don't have control of our lives. Chapter number 12. Now that we know what happened about the vow, we go back to what happened at the end of the Ammonite conflict. Chapter 12. The men of Ephraim... Remember, those Ephraim is across the river, across the Jordan River to the west. The men of Ephraim were called to arms, and they crossed to Zaphon, and they said to Jephthah, why did you cross over to fight against the Ammonites and didn't call us to go with you? Now, why are they so upset? As I've explained before, in ancient warfare, to the victor goes the spoils. So if you go out and fight and you win, all the goodies left by the losing side become your property. So there is to some extent great value in going to war. And so that is probably what these Ephraimites are all upset about. Maybe some of them were upset with the fact that they didn't get a chance to get their own revenge against the Ammonites, because the Ammonites, remember, have also been coming over into Ephraim and into Judah and to Benjamin, taking their stuff. So this time, they weren't asked to help. The Gileadites, and that is the Gadites, and the people of Manasseh to the north of Gilead, they're the ones that handled it. And so the Ephraimites are all upset. They come across the Jordan. They accost Jephthah, and listen to this, we're going to burn your house over you with fire. Now, that is pretty severe for not being invited to come to a war. So Jephthah said to them, I and my people had a great dispute with the Ammonites. When I called you, you did not save me from their hand. So apparently The people from Ephraim are not being straight up about this whole thing. There must have been at least some sort of messenger that went across the Jordan to invite the Israelis from Israel proper to come over and join the war. And they didn't show up. So verse 3, when I saw that you would not save me, I took my life in my own hand and crossed over against the Ammonites. And he who is gave them into my hand. Why then have you come up to me this day to fight against me? Then Jephthah gathered all the men of Gilead and fought with Ephraim. And the men of Gilead struck Ephraim because they said, "You're fugitives of Ephraim, you Gileadites, in the midst of Ephraim and Manasseh." And the Gileadites captured the fords of the Jordan against the Ephraimites. This could have ended so much more peacefully. But these Ephraimites will not let it go. And they make an accusation. Remember, we're 300 years after the entry into the Promised Land. These Ephraimites make an accusation against the eastern Israelis, the people of Gad, the people of Reuben, and half the tribe of Manasseh that all are over on this east side. You guys don't even belong to Israel. You're not true Israelis. You're renegades. Now, that was the whole reason that the eastern Israelis had built that altar replica there at the fords of the Jordan, somewhere between Shiloh and Gilead, because they wanted a permanent marker to show that they were affiliated with the religion of Israel proper, with the religion that was centered at Shiloh. And way back at that time, remember, there was almost a civil war that happened. But once it was explained, it was accepted as a reasonable thing to do. Well, I am always curious when I get to this story. Was that altar marker still there? The next part of the story, does it happen right next to where that marker was that proved that the Eastern Israelis were worshipers of the true and living God? Just a curiosity of mine. So the Gileadites, the Gilead army, fights against the invading Ephraimite army, beats them, and then they set up a border checkpoint between Gilead and Ephraim. Verse number 5, the Gileadites captured the fords of the Jordan against the Ephraimites. And when any of the fugitives of Ephraim said, these are the guys that got beat and they want to get back to Ephraimite territory. When these guys said, "Let me go over at the checkpoint," understand, the men of Gilead would say to them, "Are you an Ephraimite?" And he would say, "No, I'm not an Ephraimite." And so they would say to him, and I've got to rephrase how it's represented here, because the point is pronunciation of a certain word. And so the word that is used here is in reference to the head of a stalk of grain. That's what the word means. So it would appear that the Gileadite border crossing guards would hold up a little stalk of grain and say, "All right, what's this?" And so the people from Ephraim would say, "Oh, that's Sibboleth." But the Ephraimite people, Gileadite people pronounced it with an SH at the beginning, Shibboleth. So it just a very slight difference in accent for spoken Hebrew, spoken Israeli. That's all that they were looking for here. So hold up the little head of grain, say, "What's this?" And based on how you answered, told the border guard whether you really were a Gileadite or an Ephraimite. So they said to him, "Say Shibboleth." And they'd say, "Sibboleth." And he could not pronounce it right. And then they would seize him and they slaughtered him at the fords of the Jordan. And at that time, 42,000 Ephraimites fell. Think about that. 42,000 people from the tribe of Ephraim died because they couldn't pronounce the word that means a head of a stalk of grain. No, actually, it's not because of their speech issue. It's because they thought they were better than the Gileadites and invaded Gileadite territory and were going to whoop up on them, and instead they got whooped up on. And this is actually another illustration of the thematic phrase that keeps popping up through the book of Judges. There was no king in Israel in those days, including they didn't look at God in his kingship. And so everyone did as they saw fit in their own eyes. So everybody was doing their own thing. Everybody was making up their own rules. Everybody was flying by the seat of their pants. And that type of chaos leads to a lot of death. Verse number 7 tells us that Jephthah judged Israel for 6 years. Now, that's not very long. Then Jephthah the Gileadite died, and he was buried in his city in Gilead. Now, I am of the opinion that the next three judges mentioned began as contemporaries with Jephthah, and that what we see is the kind of the regional fragmentation of Israel itself. Jephthah led the eastern side of Israel for 6 years. Verse 8 tells us that after him, Ibzan of Bethlehem judged Israel. He had 30 sons and 30 daughters he gave in marriage outside his clan, and 30 daughters he brought in from outside for his sons. And he judged Israel 7 years. Then Ibzan died and was buried at Bethlehem. Now, Bethlehem is in Judah, in the south side, or the south part of the western side of Israel. So that's a southern region. After him, Elon the Zebulunite judged Israel, and he judged Israel 10 years. And then Elon the Zebulunite died and was buried at Aijalon in Zebulun. Now, Zebulun is up in the north. It's up in the Galilee area. And so this is also on the west side of the Jordan Valley. And so we've now got Jephthah on the east side of the Jordan Valley. We've got Ibzan on the southwest side of the Jordan Valley. We've got Elon on the northwest side of the Jordan Valley. And that only leaves one last region, doesn't it? Verse 13, after him, Abdon, the son of Hillel, the Pirathonite, judged Israel. He had 40 sons and 30 grandsons who rode on 70 donkeys, and he judged Israel 8 years. And then Abdon, the son of Hillel, the Pirathonite, died and was buried at Pirathon in the land of Ephraim in the hill country of the Amalekites. And so that's the central, the west central side of the Jordan Valley is under this guy's leadership. Each one of them, not terribly long in this position of leadership, and each one of them kind of having other people involved in their leadership from within their family. And so we do have a little bit of stability, but it is short-lived. And we know what happens every time the stability disappears. We have sin burst to the surface again, and then God allows outside forces to come in as part of the judgment, part of the curse. And that is exactly what we see in the next section that we'll introduce today and then really get started in next time. Judges chapter 13. The people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of He Who Is. So I think after all those judges were dead, all roughly around the same time span of about a decade or so, once they're all dead, all those regions start going kind of rogue again, start doing whatever they feel like. And that's evil in the sight of the Lord, especially when it involves going back into paganism, worshiping other gods and goddesses. And so what follows? God handing them over to judgment. So He Who Is gave them into the hand of the Philistines for 40 years. So the Ammonites kind of got whooped by Jephthah. So they're kind of off the table for a while. But over on the southwest corner of Israel is the Philistine five-city confederation, five city-states that are run by people that have an Aegean sort of background. And they start oppressing the Israelis, controlling the Israeli life, controlling the Israeli access to agricultural implements, and by extension, implements that can be used in warfare. And so God starts preparing the judge that He will use once it is time for that Philistine oppression to end. And so God is going to send His angel to a man in the tribe of Dan. Now, the tribe of Dan is on the western side of that corridor between Judah on the south and Manasseh on the north. And this little corridor has a little compressed area where a bunch of these Danites live. And that's where our next story is going to take place.